when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Today's episode is presented by Lloyds Banking Group. Everyone deserves a safe place to call home. That's why Lloyds Banking Group is calling for 1 million more homes to be made available for social rent by 2033.
Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider. We'll get started right after this. New Year should be a time of optimism and excitement, said Rishi Sunak in a speech at the start of 2023. Yet I know, he added, that many of you look ahead to 2023 with apprehension. I want you to know that as your Prime Minister, I'll work night and day to change that. Well, almost 12 months later, as we stand on the cusp of 2024, it's Rishi Sunak who must be looking at the year ahead with apprehension. Because 2024, as every listener of this podcast knows, is all but certain to be the year of the next UK general election. And for the British Prime Minister, miles behind in the opinion polls, and with the economy flatlining and his party badly split on immigration, the campaign ahead looks challenging, to say the least. The polls would suggest that 2024 may be a moment of significant political change in this country.
In a cry of defiance to those who write our country off, Britain can, Britain must, Britain will get its future back.
A brighter future for everyone. Be in no doubt, it is time for a change, and we are it. Thank you.
And it's not just Britain going to the polls in 2024. The year ahead has been dubbed the planet's biggest election year in history, with votes in many of the world's most populous nations and blocs, including the USA, India, and the European Union, as well as in hotspots such as Taiwan and Ukraine. Even Russia has presidential elections in 2024, though I think we can all guess who the winner is likely to be there. And of course, beyond these great democratic and sometimes anti-democratic exercises, the world's existing crises are not going away. A land war in Europe, a desperate conflict in the Middle East, and economic uncertainty for so many around the world. But look, it's not all bad news. There's an Olympic Games in Paris to look forward to, and with the Euros in Germany also looming this summer, 2024 might just be the year the England men's football team finally brings home some gold. So from Politico, I'm Jack Blanchard, and this week on Westminster Insider, I and a host of experts are bringing you the year ahead in one single podcast and asking if the biggest election year in history is going to bring a little stability or yet more chaos to us all. In 2024, Rishi Sunak faces his moment of truth. Sunak has been Prime Minister for 14 rollercoaster months, trying to steady the ship after the madness of the Boris Johnson and Liz Truss regimes, while struggling with a battered economy and a deeply divided party.
Cocooned in his party management breakfast, he just can't see the country in front of him and what they've done.
In a three-page letter, Suella Braverman said to Rishi Sunak he'd broken all his assurances to her.
Shameless opportunism!
His hope had been to head into this election year with Labour's poll lead at least starting to narrow. But it hasn't worked out like that.
So the really interesting thing about 2023 is that for all of the political drama that we've seen, actually, the polls have basically been static throughout the year.
This is Luke Trill, UK director of the research organisation More in Common, which undertakes polling work and voter focus groups around the country. I asked him to set the scene for the election year to come.
Obviously, there have been ups and downs. But if you look at the kind of big picture, at the start of this year, we were looking at a 16-17 point average Labour lead in the opinion polls. Closing the year, we're in pretty much the same position. Our latest poll had a 15-point Labour lead. It's been about there since the summer. So in big picture terms, what that means is if there were an election tomorrow, we'd be looking not just at a Labour victory, but quite a comfortable Labour victory. And the Tories really going down to kind of their core vote.
Okay, so the Tories have obviously got it all to do in 2024 to try and close that gap. And traditionally, we do see governing parties tend to improve as we get closer to election day, don't we?
We do. I guess the big question that I'm looking at is the extent to which are there factors which can help the Conservatives turn things around? So if the economy starts to improve, if the Conservatives get that flight off to Rwanda, if they somehow come to a deal with the junior doctors, if lots of things go right, does that start to shift it and we see a narrowing and they can play a, you know, hold on to nurse for fear of something worse card? Or are we in 1997 territory where actually, despite quite a good economic outlook, the public had kind of stopped listening and wanted change regardless? And I think that's what we'll start to find out in the early months of next year. Is there anything that can shift the tide at all? Or actually, are we just on course for one of those, you know, what become known as change elections?
When you talk to Tory strategists, they talk about a large tranche of voters who are apparently still undecided, and they are optimistic, or they try to be optimistic, that in that group, they may find the surge in support that they need to close that gap. Is that right? And is that plausible?
So I think there are two factors which will give the Tories some hope. One is electoral volatility in general. You know, the Tories have been as high as 53% in this parliament in one opinion poll and as low as 14%. You know, gone are the days when people made up their mind and stuck with a party sometimes for life. So that will be one hope. The second hope, as you say, is that group of voters, the don't knows. And when you look at that group of voters, they do lean more right than the average member of the public. It's why if you do a focus group with don't knows now, actually you find them, you know, actually quite aligned with what you might call Tory policies on a range of issues. The big question, and I think this is the Tory hope, is can they persuade that group that actually it is still better to have a Conservative government after the election and they need to come out and vote? It will be a challenge. But the one thing I would say is that group alone won't be enough. There are two other groups. If, you know, if we want to see a Conservative majority after the election, they will firstly need to take back some of those voters who've gone to Reform UK. And then they need to get back some of those direct switchers. It is almost impossible to see a way for Rishi Sunak to stay in power without winning back some people who've gone directly from the Conservatives to Labour.
Just on Reform UK, there is obviously the apparently growing prospect of Nigel Farage coming out of the jungle triumphant as he did the other day and launching himself into 2024 back into frontline politics as some sort of figurehead for that party. Is there a prospect of support building for Reform in 2024 rather than ebbing back to the Conservatives and actually causing Rishi Sunak an even bigger nightmare?
I think that's a real risk. So some analysis that we've done suggests that if the Reform poll figures are real, then they're already in danger of costing the Conservatives somewhere in the region of 30 to 40 seats. So really not insignificant. And of course, the higher that Reform vote goes, the higher the risk largely to the Conservatives is. But of course, they're in a catch-22 because there'll be some people, you know, particularly in the ERG and elsewhere, who'll be saying this shows the route to success is to hug Farage close, actually, to try and go and fight on Reform's turf. But there are two risks to that. One is the Conservatives, of course, can lose voters the other way. And they're not only going to be playing defence in places like the Red Wall, which are more socially conservative, but also that so-called Blue Wall in the southeast of England, where the Liberal Democrats and in some cases Labour will be hoping to take some, you know, formerly heartland Conservative seats. And they don't like Nigel Farage at all. And there's a real risk of alienating them. But also there's some evidence, and we saw this in the Netherlands recently with Geert Wilders, that where right-wing, centre-right parties try and play on the turf of the populist right, actually all you end up doing is emboldening the populist right. So it's not clear that there's an easy answer for the Conservatives on how to deal with that Reform UK problem.
And just finally on Labour, we keep hearing that Keir Starmer hasn't set the world on fire with voters, he hasn't sealed the deal. Is that the sense you get from your focus groups?
I think if there is a worry for Labour, it's that I think they've reached peak not being the Tories. People get it, right? They recognise that the Tories have done, they think the Tories have done a bad job. They're quite eager for change. Yet they haven't heard from Labour, and particularly the Labour leader, what they would do differently. So it's interesting when you do focus groups, you're actually much more likely to get a sort of pox on all their houses vibe back from the public rather than enthusiasm for Labour. And so I think it is fair to say that Labour at the moment are winning by default. And there's no bad thing about winning by default. Lots of oppositions win by default. But if I were Keir Starmer and his team, I'd be worried about that for two reasons. One is, you know, if the electorate continued to be as volatile and things do start to look up and, you know, the Conservatives manage to behave themselves for a whole year in the run-up to the election, there is certainly the chance that enough of those don't knows come back to force it to a hung parliament. You know, that wouldn't surprise me as an outcome. But secondly, there's also a risk that Keir Starmer gets in on the back of not being the Tories, but doesn't really have a mandate with the public, and things go south quite quickly. Because we know he's not going to be coming into a great economic situation. And so my worry if I were Labour is he could come in, become quite unpopular quite quickly, and actually end up out of office after a single term, historically unusual though that would be.
So while Labour may not have a landslide victory in the bag just yet, the picture undoubtedly looks bleak for Rishi Sunak. What will he try to do this coming year to turn things around? Well, the first challenge he faces when he returns to Downing Street in January is to secure the passage through Parliament of his proposed laws to override the legal challenges to his Rwanda deportation plan, his big play on illegal immigration.
And today's bill also ends the merry-go-round of legal challenges that have blocked our policy for far too long.
What a fine mess this weak Prime Minister has got them all into and got the country into as well. Tearing lumps out of each other over a failing policy while they let the country down.
Sunak's legislation faces opposition from every side of the House of Commons, including Tories on both wings of his own party, the One Nation group on the left, and the so-called five families of rebels on the right. And it faces a major battle in the House of Lords as well, if it ever gets that far. So the big question in Tory circles as we head into this new year is whether this landmark piece of legislation is actually going to make it onto the statute book.
So I think it's likely he gets it through in some form. The question is, how much is it amended? How different is it than what they first proposed?
This is Katie Balls, political editor at The Spectator magazine and an expert on Tory Kremlinology.
In a way, it is the One Nation Tories, those on the left of the party, who have the most room for manoeuvre at the next stage, because they have the potential option of maybe teaming up with Labour, Lib Dems. Whereas who is going to team up with Marc Francois and the ERG? Of course, you have the five families, but they're not actually that large in numbers when it comes to having to work with opposition parties. So I think at the moment, there is still a chance Rishi Sunak gets us pretty clean through the House of Commons, in the sense I think some of the One Nation MPs are more making these warning shots to say, if the right of the party are going to demand all these changes when ultimately the left are living with a bill they don't like that much, they'll demand some too. So I think you have a frantic Christmas New Year period with Numbertown trying to talk rebels on both sides down. And then I think you get to the House of Lords point. And I think that's always been seen where it could be stopped. But speaking to Labour figures, I think they are a little bit wary of falling into a trap where Rishi Sunak can turn around and say, it was Labour peers in the House of Lords that stopped this. When actually they think almost if it does go through, there's still a chance it doesn't work. And that would be the worst scenario for Rishi Sunak.
So he has a long struggle through the early weeks and maybe months of the year and finally gets onto the statute book, and then we find out whether it's even effective.
Exactly. And I think that would probably be the point where it would be the most difficult for Rishi Sunak. Suddenly you'd have figures such as Suella Braverman and Robert Jenrick proved right. But for that danger point to get to, you almost need him to have some success in the meantime.
At the same time, he'll have Isaac Levido joining CCHQ in January, trying to ramp up the Tory election machine. Sunak's going to have to make a decision fairly quickly about when that election is going to be held, or at least very roughly when. What do you think the thinking is at the moment in Number 10?
I think the truth is Number 10 is divided on when the election should be. So when everyone says Number 10 wants spring, Number 10 wants autumn, both can be correct. It depends which person and which part of the building you're speaking to. I think those who feel very experienced in campaigns think it would be madness to go in the spring, just in the sense the polling is this bad. If you're 20 points behind, you should take the time and try and improve things. But I think those who are more to do with the day-to-day running worry not so much. It's not so much, oh, spring could be a lovely time to have an election. It's, is the autumn going to be even worse? Rishi has now said it will definitely be 2024. As for which we're going, I'm probably a 45% spring, 55% autumn girl, which I know is completely unhelpful to anyone.
They've obviously got a huge gap to close in the polls. They've stubbornly refused to move for the full first year of Rishi Sunak's premiership. He's still around 20 points behind. What do you think the strategy will be through 2024 to try and close that gap?
We're already seeing the beginnings of the Tory strategy. Now, given the Tory strategy seems to have changed a few times in the past few months, it could move around, but I think the broad structure, they want to make it about lower taxes under the Tories. We've taken the difficult decisions. Now we can cut tax. Whereas Labour want to borrow £28 billion for their Green Plan, and they can't be trusted, and they're going to hurt you financially. Then depending on what happens with Rwanda, that could be thrown in the mix. If it goes very badly, could we see something on the ECHR? I don't think that's impossible. The other element will, of course, be attacking Keir Starmer's character. And we've heard a lot, I think since the summer, it's come back again about this dossier on Keir Starmer's time as DPP and these cases. But I also think you're going to see, you know, the fact there's just video footage of Keir Starmer saying Jeremy Corbyn is his friend, then saying he's not his friend, you know, talking about net migration figures, but then also talking about freedom of movement and all those things put together to try and make it a choice between Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak rather than Labour and the Tories.
If the Tory campaign can't close this gap and the Tories are defeated, as the polls currently suggest they will we see a Tory leadership contest in 2024?
Yes, I think that's highly likely. I think the only way Rishi Sunak could stay on is if things look like they could fall already at any moment under a Labour government or a hung parliament. And therefore, you can make the case, I've got to stay on for these reasons. I think if it looks like a stable Labour win, going to have a change of leader.
And what a Tory leadership contest look like in 2024, do you think?
It slightly depends on the scale of the defeat. If you have below 200 Tory MPs, you know, the lower it gets in terms of the number, the more unpredictable I think that contest is. There's been lots of research saying actually the Tories could really go for a moderate because lots of the safe seats are One Nation Tories, Cameroons and so forth. But also you have Suella Braverman has a pretty safe seat. Kemi Badenoch has a pretty safe seat. John Hayes has a very safe seat. And in a knockout round, it can be quite unpredictable. I think the worse the defeat, the higher the chance you have of a complete, you know, wild card candidate. There's almost going to be merit in being able to say, I had nothing to do with that.
So what does a wild card candidate look like? You want to throw us a name or two around?
The one to beat is Kemi Badenoch in terms of if you actually wanted to place money in a way that would be your least risky way. If you want to go for a wild card, I mean, let's see who keeps their seats. I think if Miriam Cates somehow hung on to her seat, and currently, you know, there's questions about whether she will, but if she did, I think the right of the party would be quite attracted to her as their candidate.
Boris Johnson come back in 2024? Is that possible at all?
I think a Boris Johnson comeback is possible. And I think had he not this year quit the Commons, would be having very different conversations. So I think it's possible, but I think it would probably take a bit longer than a year. You almost can imagine the first successor in the event of a Tory defeat being someone else. And maybe if that doesn't work out, or the party veers too much one way, you know, has its own version of the Jeremy Corbyn experiment, and potentially Boris Johnson a seasoned politician would come in for the second round.
All right. Well, maybe we'll have you back next December and ask you if that's going to happen in 2025.
pivotal, of course, to the Tories' re-election prospects will be their stewardship of the UK economy. From inflation to energy prices, from mortgage rates to the total and utter lack of growth, economic news has dominated the political landscape for the past 2 years. Will that continue through 2024?
Economics always matters in politics, and certainly in the run-up to the election, and with all the anxieties around the cost of living crisis.
This is David Willetts, Conservative peer and president of the Resolution Foundation, one of Britain's most respected economic think tanks.
We can certainly expect a year with inflation coming down, though there might be a surprise rise in January just because of what falls out of the index 12 months ago. But I think there is very likely that CPI might get down to 3%. And so the inflation problem is certainly getting a lot better. And of course, wage growth has been relatively healthy. But our analysis of Resolution Foundation suggests next year there's going to be very kind of diverse effects amongst different groups of people. If you are a saver and you own your own home with your mortgage paid off, there's lots of affluent baby boomers in those circumstances. In those circumstances, you could well be feeling a bit better off, not least because if you've got savings in a bank, the rise in interest rates has significantly increased the amount of income you're getting. We estimate that interest rate payments to depositors are rising from £4 billion a year when interest rates were low to £60 billion a year because of higher interest rates. That's a big surge in potentially in living standards for older savers. However, if you are a homeowner with either trying to take out a mortgage or with a mortgage due to be renewed, or perhaps you've just joined the housing ladder recently, in other words, you're a borrower and they tend to be younger people. Younger people on the housing ladder may well see their mortgage costs continuing to rise. And of course, that's also feeding through into higher rents for people in private rented accommodation.
And the law of politics would suggest that those feeling the pain tend to blame the government, don't they?
That's inevitable. Looking back to my time in politics, that's going to be a factor. And I personally do think that the sort of politically salient group will be groups like first-time buyers, recent mortgagers, people who, for whatever reason, have got higher borrowings, and that does tend to be younger people. They will be feeling the squeeze and they may not be fully compensated for by their pay increases, whereas older generation homeowners without a mortgage, perhaps pretty much insulated from the state of the labour market, they getting the triple lock and higher payments on their bank deposits, they could feel that life looks pretty good.
If you're the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, you'll be painfully aware of everything you've just said, I'm sure. You're already looking ahead to a budget in March, which is likely to be the last one before, well, pretty certain to be the last one before a general election. What will he be thinking about as he considers what more he can do to help the economy, but frankly, to help the Tories have some chance of winning that election?
Well, I think in the autumn statement, his tax cuts were very well judged. The national insurance cut particularly helped earners. It was targeted on people at work. So it actually was better targeted than a general income tax cut that helps a much wider group, some who are very affluent.
And of course, that's kicking in January. So people will start to feel that at the start of 2024.
Absolutely. And he was clearly keen to get the benefits feeding through. And he will be thinking about trying to get investment going and growth going. Because let's face it, the story of the British economy since the crash, and especially the last few years, has sadly been pretty flat growth and not sufficient productivity improvements to get the economy going. He's also got some decisions to take about how tight the squeeze is on public services, because they've not all had full protection from inflation over the past few years. And I think he'll be drawing a balance between how much he needs to hold on to his money to ensure that public services carry on functioning well over the coming year, and how much has got available for tax cuts. But I think this week's announcement on local government finance is an example. I mean, what if more local authorities get into financial difficulties over the coming year? There are areas where he'll be thinking he does actually have to put a bit of extra money into public services to ease the pressures.
But what about the Labour Party? is Keir Starmer sitting back in his office, feet on desk, cigar in hand, watching those unshifting polls with a smile on his face, preparing for life in Downing Street in 2024?
Look, they won't admit as much, but I'd say most Labour MPs now think Keir Starmer being Prime Minister, Labour getting into government, is a question of when, not if.
This is Patrick Maguire, the Times columnist and Westminster's favourite Starmer watcher.
Their campaign team are the only sort of doomsayers left who say we've got a long way to go, we've got a lot of vulnerabilities, everything could change over the course of the campaign. Morgan McSweeney recently said it will only take Labour losing a couple of points off their poll lead before the Tories can form a minority government or even a very narrow majority government.
We will continue to fight like we're 5 points behind all the way in to this election.
If you talk to people who do lots of focus groups, they hear people complaining that they still don't really know what the Labour Party stand for, that they're always criticising, but they don't have their solutions of their own. Do you think we're going to see through the course of 2024 in the run-up to the election some big showcase policy ideas from Keir Starmer and his team that we haven't heard before?
When he launched the missions, his five missions this time last year, a lot of people thought, well, what do these mean? You know, these five sort of slightly highfalutin, vague missions. So the challenge for the Labour Party is to turn those into retail policies. And yeah, I think we will see sort of slightly more abstract elements of Labour's platform, like the controversial £28 billion of borrowing for green investment, boiled down into a constituency level. These are how many houses in your seat that are going to have free insulation from the government or whatever. So I think it'll less be sort of radical new ideas than translating the sort of slightly abstract theoretical language Keir Starmer has been speaking in into retail policies. And that will be the tricky thing, because, of course, the first question anyone will ask is, how are you paying for this?
Do you see risks for Keir Starmer in 2024 as he seemingly coasts along to victory? Do you see any potential areas where it could all start to go wrong? Can you imagine a scenario where it starts to go wrong and he finds himself under real pressure?
The outstanding issues for the Labour Party are Keir Starmer himself. That's the long and short of it. Keir Starmer is polling much lower than his party. The Labour brand is much stronger than Keir Starmer's brand. So the point of vulnerability and the untested thing is how Keir Starmer copes over a year of national campaigning, essentially. This is going to be a year-long or 6 months long or 9 months long election campaign. And Keir Starmer's never done that before. So what are the vulnerabilities? Well, it's what you just said that people are bringing up in those focus groups. It's his character. Will voters necessarily warm to him? How does he explain his political metamorphosis? I mean, these are all things he's done with varying degrees of success to a sort of Westminster audience. But we all know, despite podcasts like this being the most important media outlets in the world and newspapers like The Times, that voters aren't really going to pay any attention to the conversations we've been having for yonks until an election campaign, the full glare of an election campaign. So that's the vulnerability.
If we look beyond a 2024 election, then the likelihood would appear to be that at some point in 2024, we will see a Labour government being formed for the first time in so many years. Do you think they are match fit? Are they ready to hit the ground running this operation?
That's a really, really good question. And it's one I get wildly varying answers on. Sue Gray's arrival as chief of staff was meant to ensure the answer was yes. But as she runs the rule over the Labour machine, I hear quite grisly things about the meetings in which she examines the party's policy preparations. She's apparently very unimpressed with the state of some of their offer and whether it's able to be implemented in government. I'd say, you know, there are lots of shadow ministers who are slightly spooked by the prospect of going into government, because don't forget, these are people, most of them, who have never, ever served in government. The key thing for Keir Starmer is sort of coming in and setting up Whitehall in a way that, you know, makes clear that this is a different kind of government and he wants to sort of do things differently and mould the ship of state into a new sort of, into a new configuration. The problem is, how many people have we heard come in with lofty ambitions like that? I mean, you remember Dominic Cummings and his Whitehall control room. These things are often easier said than done.
Just lastly, Patrick, in this imaginary world towards the end of 2024 with a Prime Minister Keir Starmer, presumably the size of his majority or whether he managed to achieve majority at all is crucial to what sort of leadership he'll be able to provide.
Well, exactly. And this is why the Labour leadership has spent so much time at the grassroots of the Labour Party, winning over individual constituency parties, putting loads and loads of time and effort and resources into getting their chosen people selected. They'll want to win big. So Keir has a PLP, a Parliamentary Labour Party, of his own people. But if it's a majority of less than, say, 30, suddenly the Scottish Labour Party, who have their own policy objectives, the Socialist Campaign Group, Northern MPs who might want to caucus around Andy Burnham or have different objectives to their colleagues in the South and South East, will suddenly all have their own objectives. And you can see that small majority fragmenting pretty quickly, particularly as the going gets tough and a Labour government is forced to do things that don't necessarily align with Labour values.
Now, it's important to remember as we look ahead to 2024 that the UK general election is not the only big vote taking place this coming year. We already know about one by-election in Wellingborough, most likely in early February, another supposedly safe Tory seat that Rishi Sunak is probably braced to lose, and several more could follow before the year is out. Then on May the 2nd, we'll have local and mayoral elections with Sadiq Khan, Andy Burnham and other big regional figures up for re-election. And it's possible too, though far from certain, that we might see fresh elections in Stormont too, if the Northern Irish deadlock continues. But surely, surely we'll finally see some movement on power sharing in 2024. Surely the DUP will finally give way and strike some sort of deal with Sinn Féin. Won't they?
Something's got to give. A lot of people, and you know, certainly I've talked to you about this over the past year, when will the DUP move? And the answer is very, very slowly.
This is Sean Bogachnik, Ireland correspondent for Politico.
My own experience in this is watching the DUP move from 2002 to 2007. For the longest time, it looked like they would never agree to share power at all with Sinn Féin. And then in 2007... the breakthrough came, but it took 5 years. So I'm used to watching the DUP move very, very slowly and then suddenly pivoting in ways that surprise you. At some point, the DUP will go back into government with Sinn Féin. It may take the British general election to clear the stage for a new engagement between a new British government and the parties in Northern Ireland, or we could get an agreement next month.
Regardless of what happens in Northern Ireland, the chances are we will see a general election too south of the border in 2024. And that, too, could have major repercussions for those of us back here in the UK.
For the first time since the modern Sinn Féin Party was founded in Belfast in January of 1970, we could get Sinn Féin leading a government of Ireland. It's astounding how quickly that party has grown and how much it has pivoted over the last 30 years since the IRA ceasefire back in the mid-1990s. Back in 1997, Sinn Féin had one TD, aka MP, in the Irish Parliament, and they are now positioned to become the largest party very easily in the next election.
Is becoming the largest party the same thing as running the government? Just talk us through the system and how that might play out.
Yeah, it's extremely different from the British first-past-the-post system, where you have only one winner in each constituency. In Ireland, it's much more of a traditional European system of multi-seat constituencies. So, say in the British system, you could get 40% of the vote and have a thumping majority. In Ireland, that gets you nothing but the first right to try to form a government. So, say if Sinn Féin gets 40% of the vote in the Irish system, they might end up winning 65 out of the 174 seats in the Parliament. Not enough for a majority, they would need a coalition partner. And that's the big difference. Just because Sinn Féin wins the most seats in the upcoming election, which everyone expects will happen, that doesn't mean Sinn Féin leads the next government. They have to find a coalition partner, another party willing to work with them.
If Sinn Féin can find a coalition partner and, of course, wins the majority of seats that the polls are predicting, what are the implications of that, both for Ireland and potentially for the UK as well?
The first thing is that we could be very well looking at an island of Ireland, where Sinn Féin is the lead party of government, both in Belfast and Dublin. You know, that's really a culmination of the Sinn Féin project. You know, Sinn Féin, of course, wants to unite Ireland. What better way to do it than by seizing control of the reins of power in both parts of Ireland?
What does that tell us about the prospects one day of a united Ireland if the Irish people and the Northern Irish people have both selected a pro unification party to run the government?
This is the perennial talking point. Are we anywhere nearer to a vote to unite Ireland? And the answer is, depending on who you talk to, it's either very close because of the effects of Brexit and the growth of Sinn Féin, or the realpolitik is we're nowhere nearer than we were 20 years ago. One instructive aspect of this is to look at how Sinn Féin itself is structured. It is the only all-Ireland party. It's the only party that, well, significant-sized party, to contest elections both in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The others are partitionist. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael do not participate in Northern politics. So if you wanted to vote for Irish unity, it makes sense to vote for Sinn Féin because they're the only ones actually active in both jurisdictions. However, Sinn Féin has separate party structures in the two parts of Ireland. They are themselves, in practical terms, partitionist. They have separate leadership, North and South. Now, they come together as a national party. But their own structure reflects the reality that Northern Ireland is a very different place than the Republic of Ireland. And whenever you want to talk about the practical scenarios for how to unite these two jurisdictions, there's a panoply of problems. And a lot of the issues for the Northern nationalists boil down to actually preferring things about how Northern Ireland does its business than how the Republic of Ireland does its business.
So there you have it. A truly seismic year awaits in British and Irish politics. But with so much going on around the world in 2024, how much of any of this is going to matter? In part two of this podcast, we'll be discussing the great global events that will overshadow and potentially blow up anything that these tiny islands have to offer. Whether that's war and peace in Europe and Asia, a trade embargo on the microchips that make the world go round, or perhaps the return of Donald Trump. Stay with us.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
A message from Lloyds Banking Group. Lloyds Banking Group has been a champion of social housing for decades. And since 2018, it has provided more than £17 billion to the sector. Working with Crisis, the national charity for people experiencing homelessness, Lloyds Banking Group is campaigning for 1 million more homes for social rent to be made available over the next decade. Affordable, sustainable, and high-quality homes are the foundation of a healthy society and prosperous economy. Yet it is estimated that more than 8.5 million people in the UK cannot access the housing they need. Find out more about why this is so important and how it contributes to Lloyds Banking Group's commitment to helping Britain prosper at lloydsbankinggroup.com.
. 2024 is the year of big ticket elections, with India going to the polls in the spring, the European Parliament in the summer, and the USA in late autumn. But it's just possible that the most consequential election of the year will happen in early January on a small island at the confluence of the South and East China Seas. Taiwan holds its presidential election on January the 13th, 2024, and with the incumbent president Tsai Ing-wen poised to leave office after two terms in power, both China and the US will be watching what happens with keen interest.
So this current president is stepping down, and this is an open race between a candidate which Beijing has labeled as pro-independence and somebody who is definitely more pro-China on the other side.
This is Stuart Lau, Politico's Europe-China correspondent.
Everybody in the region is watching very closely because, in the opinion of a lot of Taiwanese experts, they are speculating that if the candidate that China doesn't like is going to win, Beijing might use this opportunity to escalate the military tension around the South China Sea and especially Taiwan Strait. If you remember, that was 2022 when then US Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan. Beijing similarly reacted with escalation, basically encircling the strait with a 7-day sort of no-fly zone, if you like. No planes, no ships were allowed to get in and out without permission. And we're talking about an island of the world's most advanced semiconductors. 90% of the world's most advanced microchips come from Taiwan. And we need that Taiwan Strait to be open in order to facilitate trade and all that in 2024. But now, Beijing is keeping everyone guessing.
The West is hoping, though, that the pro-independence candidate wins. Is that broadly correct?
So the US plays, of course, the most significant security role in Taiwan. And the DPP, the pro-independence party, has a very good working relationship with the US. It's fair to say that the US has been, you know, giving a lot of security support to this government. And of course, you know, if the next Taiwanese president is going to be more pro-China, of course, that's going to be quite an embarrassing moment for the US government. You know, after spending 8 years cultivating ties with Taiwan, it seems that the Taiwanese public at this stage, they're still not quite sure which way to go. If you look at the popularity polls, the gap is narrower than thought by a lot of people. I think it's between 5 and 8 percentage points the last time I checked. For now, the pro-independence candidate is still the front runner.
What is the worst case scenario here? Like, how serious could this get if China decides it doesn't like this election result?
Xi Jinping, the president of China, has always made it very clear that China doesn't rule out military options as a last resort to facilitate what he calls reunification. If peaceful means lead nowhere, there are a lot of military hawks on Beijing's side saying that it's time to get Taiwan back. If you look at the elections, they're definitely not getting more pro-Beijing over time. You know, they're becoming less and less, actually, especially for the younger generation who feel less of an emotional affinity with China or Chineseness. It all depends on what Xi Jinping thinks. You know, it's come down to basically one-man power in China. Of course, he's also facing a lot of domestic pressure economically. That's why he traveled to San Francisco to meet President Joe Biden. There was also the EU-China summit in Beijing just a few weeks ago. So there was this phase of China from Xi Jinping personally that he still wants to engage the West. And for now, he's walking a very fine line on Taiwanese politics.
Even if the Taiwanese election does not trigger further tensions in the South China Seas, there are, of course, plenty of ongoing conflicts for the world to worry about in 2024. The war in Ukraine, the bloody struggle between Israel and Hamas in the Middle East, and now conflict over commercial shipping in the Red Sea, too. Rarely in living memory has the world felt as unstable as it does today.
There are more simultaneous crises going on than I can remember at any time in my career.
This is Peter Ricketts, former Downing Street National Security Advisor and the former head of the UK Foreign Office.
And I think part of this is that both Putin and Xi Jinping feel emboldened to push forward and have had a sense that the Americans have been pulling back from international leadership. So we see that most clearly in Ukraine, but it's also very much the case, I think, in Israel and Gaza as well, where the Americans have not had the kind of leadership role that they've had in previous Middle East crises.
Presumably, at some point in 2024, the bombing in Gaza is going to end with some sort of negotiated settlement. What would you expect to happen?
Of course, the fighting is going to end at some point, but right now it's extremely hard to predict exactly how it will end. Ideally, a crisis of this intensity and depth will lead to new thinking, both in Israel and on the Palestinian side, that the previous policy of putting security above everything else in Israel and the policy of allowing Hamas to mount attacks on Israel from Gaza, both of those have failed and have brought catastrophe to Gaza. And so I hope that there'll be an opportunity to think again and to find a way of creating a new Palestinian leadership who will be interested in negotiating peaceful coexistence with Israel and an Israeli government prepared to make that happen. But it could go the other way. It could go into Israel left occupying Gaza, which has been devastated, and no international group of countries willing to take on the task of reconstruction and rebuilding a Palestinian authority. That would be a terrible outcome, but it's not impossible.
At the same time, the conflict in Ukraine continues. The counteroffensive has not been the great success that many hoped it would be in 2023. Is this war just going to carry on indefinitely, do you think, or are we going to hit a crunch point in 2024?
The Ukrainians have been incredibly brave and resilient, but I think the limits of what they can do are now apparent. We are effectively in a stalemate. The front lines haven't really moved very much this last year, despite massive losses on both sides. And there are signs of the Western will to support Ukraine beginning to fracture. You can see that on the Republican side in Washington. You can also begin to see it in some European countries. And the difficulty of getting funding agreed on both sides of the Atlantic for 2024 is a real worry. It must be a great worry for Zelensky. My own guess is that by the summer of next year, unless there's been a breakthrough, which I don't expect, Zelensky is going to have some very difficult decisions to make. Because if there's any prospect of Trump coming back to the White House, he has to calculate, is it better to negotiate now for some sort of armistice, which would produce a de facto truce in Ukraine without either side accepting victory or defeat, and allow Ukraine, the free part of it, to make progress towards joining the EU and NATO, and therefore guaranteeing their security? Or is he willing to go on fighting even as Western support begins to tail off? And I think that critical decision point comes sometime next summer.
I've been talking about on this podcast about 2024 as a year of seismic elections around the world. And you mentioned the American one there. We also have a European election this summer. And indeed, there's supposed to be an election in Ukraine. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen or not. Will the European elections have any impact on these types of world affairs, do you think?
I don't think that's going to change things very much on Ukraine, because it's essentially governments that are making the policy on Ukraine. But Ursula von der Leyen has been a strong leader in support of Ukraine. So if she doesn't come back as president of the Commission, that could, of course, change things. And it's very relevant to the UK as well. What happens in Europe, what the landscape of European politics looks like after an EP elections that will be dominated, I suspect, by issues of immigration. That'll be a very important issue for the UK too.
And finally, the US election looming on the horizon. Already, as you mentioned, we're seeing Republican pushback on more funding for Ukraine, and presumably this issue is going to become fairly central in the American campaign. Is it possible America gets to a place in 2024 where it just pulls support for Ukraine altogether?
If we find a President Trump back in the White House in the first part of 2025, I think there's a real risk that he'll decide to cut all US support for Ukraine and try and do a deal with his buddy Putin over the heads of Zelensky and the Ukrainian government. I mean, that would be a terrible outcome for Ukraine, for European security. I think the whole prospect of a Trump presidency has to make a British government, whatever stripe it is after the UK elections next year, think again about even closer relations with the European Union. Because with a Trump in the White House, the EU and the UK will have an absolutely strong shared interest in working together.
And so our whistle-stop tour of 2024 brings us, inevitably, to the 5th of November, a date which this coming year is going to be remembered for fireworks not just in Britain, but in the United States as well.
This is not a time to be complacent. That's why I'm running for re-election.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
If Donald Trump makes it that far, surviving court judgments, a Republican primary process, and various criminal charges, it seems he has every chance of being re-elected president for a second time. And not much else that happens in the world is going to matter more than that.
It is a very, very real possibility.
This is Meredith McGraw, Politico's national political correspondent in Washington, D.C.
Not only have we seen Donald Trump just dominate in Republican primary polling, what we're seeing in hypothetical national election matchups between Donald Trump and President Joe Biden is that he has an edge even there.
He has plenty of hurdles to get through the course of 2024. And I guess the first one is the primary process, the Republican primary process. Just talk us through how that works through the course of the year.
Yeah, so the beginning of the year is really front-loaded in the U.S. with a series of caucuses and primary voting elections. It kicks off January 15th in Iowa. And right now we've seen in Iowa, Trump has been really performing very strongly in polling. You know, but at the same time, it's going to be interesting to see how Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis perform in Iowa, because their campaigns say that that could really give them momentum going into the following states. And what comes next is January 23rd in New Hampshire. And New Hampshire kind of has a more independent streak. It's up in New England. It's a different group of voters than you find in Iowa, which really skews towards evangelical white Christians. New Hampshire, they're a little bit more of an independent blue collar streak. And yet there too, Trump continues to be dominating in the polls. After New Hampshire, there is a caucus in Nevada that's happening February 8th. And then you go on to South Carolina, where Nikki Haley was once the governor of South Carolina, and she's going to be on the ballot there.
That's obviously a big one for her, right? That's her home territory, I assume.
Yes. As we've seen Nikki Haley rise in the polls, what happens in South Carolina could really just determine how the rest of things go. If Nikki Haley can't win her own home state, it really seems like all of the momentum, as we've already seen, really is going towards Donald Trump and towards Super Tuesday, March 5th, when a huge bucket of delegates could be awarded.
Donald Trump appears to be miles in front of his rivals, but we have seen, you know, front runners fall away before. Could it happen this time? Is it possible he blows this enormous lead?
You know, anything's possible in politics, as we've seen over the years. But what I think is really so extraordinary and different this time around is just how far ahead Donald Trump has been polling against his competitors. It isn't sort of the close neck and neck horse race that we've seen in past primaries. In this one, Donald Trump, he's basically running as an incumbent. He's a former president. He's the de facto leader of the Republican Party. And he's really had an enormous lead that it could be really, really hard for any of these other candidates to catch up unless something truly unforeseen happens here.
So if it's not the primary system that trips him up, maybe it'll be the court system that trips him up, right? He's got a lot of different legal cases. We saw one just this week in Colorado, and there are obviously several others as well. What's the general sense in Washington? Is it possible for someone facing all these different legal challenges to make it all the way to a presidential election in November?
Well, one would think that having 91 indictments and staring down a really complicated schedule of court appearances would trip up a candidate, would make a difference here. What we've seen for Trump in polling is that it's actually hardened a lot of the support among Republican primary voters and really just emphasizes, underscores his own narrative that the legal system is skewed against him, and he's the victim here of a grand conspiracy to keep him out of office again.
So if he's right and he can navigate the court system and he can stroll through the primaries, he makes it into that head-to-head, we assume, with President Biden, and it gets down to the final debates in October and the vote in November. Is your sense this is going to be a very tight election? It could be very close either way.
Yeah, I've always felt like this election will be close. Right now, we've seen Donald Trump lead in polling against President Biden. And that's sort of tracks historically with how things go for incumbents at this point in the race. You know, we still have 11 months until the November elections, and a lot can change. And for an incumbent president for the White House, they have a lot of time to make their argument with voters. But we have seen some of the arguments against President Biden be pretty salient with voters when it comes to issues like the economy or immigration. Those are topics that a lot of voters are thinking about, and President Biden's own approval ratings haven't been too great, and he's going to have to really turn things around in the next few months to get some momentum going into November.
And just finally, is Washington ready for the return of President Donald Trump?
Oh my gosh. I did a story recently with some of my colleagues who cover Capitol Hill, cover the Senate, and cover the House. And they asked senators, Republicans on the Hill, what they thought of the potential of Donald Trump returning. I don't think anybody in Washington is quite ready for it. Donald Trump really shook things up the last time he was here. And for those senators, I don't know if they're ready to be answering questions every day about what Donald Trump has posted to Truth Social. So I'm sure everybody is, you know, watching closely to see how things go here.
So that's 2024, a year of seismic elections and, sorry to break it to you, seemingly endless political turmoil. More than any other year in history, where we end up will largely depend on the will of small groups of voters in a handful of unexpectedly powerful places, like Ohio in the Midwest of America, or Workington in the northwest of England, or the suburbs of Taipei City. What sort of world emerges at the end of this year rests in their, and I guess all of our hands. Here at Westminster Insider, we'll be buckling up, taking a very deep breath, and talking you through it all, stage by stage, along the way. Happy New Year! Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider. If you've enjoyed it, do please follow us wherever you get your podcasts, and why not leave us a nice review as well? That's it for Season 12, but we'll be back at the start of February for another year of interviews, documentaries, and fun thoughts about British politics. My producers this week were James Tyndale, Artemis Irvin, and Robert Nicholson of Whistledown Productions. And I'll see you all in 2024.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.